You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Battle Hymn by Sam Tannenhaus. DeSantis' war on woke in Florida schools and sorted it into a catalog of proscriptions, strict book bans in various school districts, rolling back diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, reducing tenure protections, and reviewing core courses to make sure they're free of liberal indoctrination. It doesn't stop at K through 12, of course. DeSantis has backed a political ally, the Senate flameout Ben Sasse, former president of a small Lutheran college in Nebraska, to be president of the University of Florida in Gainesville at a salary of $1 million a year. DeSantis has gotten even bigger headlines for targeting New College of Florida, a tiny liberal arts school in Sarasota, a haven for students such as X. Gonzalez, one of the most political and vocal survivors of the horrific Parkland slaughter, now a leader in the gun control movement. With its progressive curriculum and largely left-leaning student body, New College was ripe for attack. If DeSantis seemed to show little interest in what was going on in Ave Maria's classrooms, he more than made up for it here, firing its president, whom he replaced, at more than double the pay, with another political crony, and adding to its board of trustees six veteran culture warriors called from the upper tiers of the new Right Brain Trust. One, Charles Kessler, comes from the Claremont Institute, the conservative West Coast stronghold that used to be aligned with Trump, but has since switched to DeSantis and has opened a new office in Tallahassee. Another is Christopher Rufo, whose crusade against critical race theory has made him, at 38, a household name on the right. A third is Matthew Spaulding, a dean at Hillsdale, the famous Michigan college, whose influence penetrates the inner sanctums of the political cultural right. The plan, it soon emerged, was to remodel quirky woke New College into a Gulf Coast version of Hillsdale. What DeSantis is doing in Florida, other governors, moguls, and cultural gadflies are constructing or contemplating in states across the nation, from the Civics Institute at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, to a Hillsdale Extension campus in Washington, D.C. This leads to another strain of Catholic conservatism, a growing but almost unnoticed presence on elite American campuses, independently funded humanist institutes. Harvard has one, so do Princeton and Columbia. I visited Yale's, the Elm Institute, a center of philosophical inquiry and reflection, is housed in a two-story brick building just off campus. Its director, Patrick Huff, who is unpretentious and soft-spoken and steeped in Aristotle and Aquinas, he quotes both in conversation, began by letting me know he has a rule of not talking to journalists and was doing so now under strict off-the-record conditions. This reticence is one reason so few know about Elm or are aware that its writer-in-residence, a friend of Huff's since school days, is New York Times columnist Ross Douthat, probably the most influential Catholic pundit of our time. I found the aura of secrecy a bit off-putting until I stepped into the sparsely furnished library with its long table and comfort snacks for students, a balance of male and female, who come by for old-style close reading of Aquinas or Ruskin. sessions in which everyone has done the reading. Hundreds of pages absorbed on the student's own time, no extra credit, no leg up on one's peers. This is in marked contrast to the climate of the typical grind, in which competition is relentless, as we know from psychologists' alarmed reports detailing not wokeness or free speech battles, but anxiety and depression, disordered eating and suicidality, the fear of crushing student debt, the angst of sexual politics, all of it magnified by a pandemic whose toll we're nowhere close to knowing. Against this, Elm and its siblings, no one likes the term safe spaces for conservatives, and insiders point out that a surprising number of progressives are drawn to the seminars, offer escape into an older humanism, admittedly more white, more male, more Western civ, and yet imbued with nuances of language, dopey serious questions about meaning and value, excited illuminations from minds better than one's own, even if shaped or misshaped in distant times, in a world we would never want to live in. The seminars are for students, not journalists, but I spoke to several who attended them at Yale and other institutes and talked about what went on. You know how it is these days, I was told by a Harvard graduate student and Catholic convert who was excited by the seminars on Rousseau he took when he was an undergrad at Morningside Institute on Manhattan's Upper West Side, followed by going to hear Bach at Carnegie Hall, preceded by dinner in which a professor gave a primer on 18th century culture, philosophy, and politics, with no flare-ups like the one in Tar. A friend assured me this gifted young scholar would be happy to chat, and he was, as long as I didn't use his name. Why? He's hoping for a teaching career in the humanities, and was cautioned by fellow grad students that being on the record as a conservative of any sort, religious, free market, or centrist, right of center, disqualifies you for most of the mainstream institutions. The culture war is a war, after all, and the wounded are everywhere. the feast. Streaming has brought riches to viewers, even if Hollywood's learning some hard lessons. Welcome to the TV Issue, and thank you for not skipping the intro by Jeff Giles. The TV industry was not entirely sure what we wanted, so it gave us everything. The sheer tonnage of great viewing possibilities is such that even vanishing giants like the Roy family and Midge Maisel will eventually be replaced in our hearts, if never forgotten. As Joy Press and Natalie Jarvie report in these pages, the media conglomerates have been paying a steep price for the way they plunged into streaming. But even if 2023 is a scary time to make television, it's a thrilling time to watch it. By now, because your powers of deduction have been sharpened by 10,000 hours of true crime viewing, you'll have surmised that this is our annual celebration of TV, and that we're using the nascent Emmy season as an excuse to highlight transcendent talents, both in front of the camera and behind it. The premise of this issue is that TV is a collaborative medium, and that actors, who get so much of the cultural oxygen, should be praised alongside the costume designers who dress them, the writers who tell them what to say, and so on. One story here, 8 perfect episodes, will remind you of the kind of thrills that are possible when the team is working at peak capacity. We don't want to give too much away before the show even starts, but here's a sort of teaser trailer for this issue within an issue. Aubrey Plaza gives a warm, funny, frank interview to Julianne Escobedo Shepherd, who has followed her career since Plaza's early comedy sketches were on YouTube. 10 of our favorite stars, including Ali Wong and Cheryl Lee Ralph, pose for a portfolio by the British fashion photographer Dan Jackson. And Anthony Bresnahan and Maureen Ryan deliver deep and sometimes startling untold stories about hit shows of the past. The campy cult classic V and the engrossing cultural behemoth Lost, respectively. Their pieces ask, in very different ways, if the industry has changed as much on a simple human decency level as it likes to say it has. You can decide for yourself. In the meantime, we hope the issue inspires some great binges. Full stream ahead. Object Lessons, a tribute to the inanimate key players in 4 major Emmy contenders by Anthony Bresnahan and Katie Rich. There's no Emmy for Best Supporting Object, but some props are so essential they deserve one. Take the inky blank cello owned by the title character of Netflix's Wednesday, which allows Jenna Ortega's stoic heroine to reveal her inner turmoil. We wanted to find something that could express her emotional side, because she's not somebody who's going to express that, says co-showrunner Alfred Goff. Mark Scruton, Wednesday's production designer, says he offered several options to director Tim Burton, who chose an antique wooden one, reflecting the character's affection for old, battered things. In the end, Scruton says, her character became this slightly eclectic mix of traditional and new. Eclectic would be a very gentle way to describe the workshop occupied by the reclusive filmmaker named Arthur that Nick Nolte plays in Peacock's Poker Face. Visual effects supervisor Phil Tippett created Arthur's spectacular puppets, including a Zeus head with Athena bursting out of it, that turns out to be a metaphor for Arthur's tortured past. I just became obsessed with that as a sort of template for what he was going through, says star Natasha Lyonne, who also directed the episode. He's stuck between 2 worlds of the past and the present, and trying to exist despite it all. A Small Light showrunner, Joan Rader, dove deep into the past to find the inspiration for the necklace at the center of the Nat Geo Limited Series 4th episode, in which Belle Powley's Meep Geese hiding Anne Frank in the legendary Amsterdam Annex receives an unexpected gift from an old friend. Inspired by necklaces worn by Jews who were persecuted during the Spanish Inquisition, the necklace that appears to be bejeweled butterflies folds up to form a Star of David. It was a little rebellion, says Rader. Like Wednesdays, Showtime's Yellow Jackets' anti-hero Shauna can only express her true feelings in private. In this case, via the journals that the adult Shauna, Melanie Linsky, burns at the beginning of season two, with relatively little hand-wringing or drama, notes co-showrunner Jonathan Liskow. But in true Yellow Jackets fashion, there's almost certainly more to be revealed. Has she come to a true inflection point in her life, where she is willing, for better or worse, to let the past go, he teases? Or is there something else going on that we have yet to find out? Rags and riches. Television's uber-wealthy communicate their status through looks both flashy and deceptively casual by Rebecca Ford. The White Lotus, HBO. When Daphne, Megan Fay, whisk Harper, Aubrey Plaza, off on an unexpected overnight stay in a villa in Noto, the pair hit the shops wearing show-stopping looks that costume designer Alex Bovaird describes as fittingly romantic and sexy. It is Daphne's little fantasy, and she's always playful, says Bovaird of the blue-and-white-striped Prada two-piece Daphne wears once they arrive. The constant tension between them also plays out in what they wear. Daphne dresses a lot more what somebody with money should wear, says Bovaird, adding that Harper, in her taste, is much cooler than Daphne, and she's a little bit uptight. Her vintage Moschino dress, then, is a perfect little summer holiday retro look, but it's also very stiff. Both women wear designer clothes and accessories, like an Hermes bag, Cartier watch, and the Jacques Marie Mage sunglasses, lately favored by the ultra-rich. They're both thinking about what they're wearing from head to toe, Bovaird says. In real life, people who've had money for a long time maybe don't wear flashy things, but in the movie world, they do. Loot, Apple TV Plus. After she divorces her cheating husband, Molly Novak, Maya Rudolph, embarks on a journey of self-discovery, and she's got $87 billion to finance it. The Los Angeles-based philanthropist wardrobe is made up of colorful, playful designer ensembles, a little bit more wild than the East Coast world, and much more fun for me, I have to say, says costume designer Kirsten Lee Mann, who has worked with Rudolph on seven projects. One of her favorite looks is the La Double J outfit that includes a tunic, matching pants, bag, and headscarf. Those looks make everyone smile every time Maya walks onto set, she says. Molly is often out of touch with the real world around her, even though she came from humble beginnings. I see it a lot with people where they all of a sudden feel very entitled. They've lost the fact that they waitressed their way through college, she says. How do you get to the point where she feels so clueless? Still, some of Molly's looks are of more modest means, like the fuchsia Thea Gabriella pleated cape gown she wears to a gala, which cost just under $800. For men, that scene-stealing look was much more about how it fit on Rudolph than the price tag. I think sometimes people want to wear their money over what looks good on them, and I do try to veer away from that, she says. I want to have fun with fashion, but I need it to look like she looks good. Beef, Netflix. All of the characters in Beef use their clothing to communicate how they want to be seen, whether that's to gain power, hide secrets, or manipulate others. There's a range of wealth on the show, and co-costume designer Helen Huang turned to Instagram, studying Asian influencers to perfect the way Ashley Park's Naomi would dress. Even though she is wealthy, we did it where she was very conscious of her body, and she liked sort of pared back looks. But then she has a logo bag or something. She's that type of wealth, she says, of Naomi's Alexander Wang shirt and Helmut Lang pants. When you have wealth, the silhouette is changed. Maria Bello's billionaire investor Jordan uses her high-end looks to exhibit her proclivity for collecting both objects and people. Her wealth is not in the fact that she has a specifically labeled purse, but more so she's very proud of the textiles she collected in Africa, says Huang, who accessorized a black Donna Karan dress with a shawl from Bello's own travels. Most of her sleek looks are accompanied by a pop of pattern, like a black top that Huang paired with a vintage textile that she found at a costume shop. When you travel a lot, depending on your racial identity, there is an element of racial appropriation to it, says Huang. She might not be aware, but it is very apparent in the story with a mostly Asian cast. Dead Ringers, Prime Video. What do David Bowie's 80s erotic horror film The Hunger, millionaire producer Megan Ellison, and Swedish philanthropist Sigrid Rausing have in common? They were all major inspirations for costume designer Carrie Langerman when creating the looks for Jennifer Eales' Rebecca, an icy billionaire who is considering investing in a luxury fertility clinic. Her uniform seems simple on the surface, a nice, loose-fitting button-down with a cigarette pant leg, but Langerman would often top it with an extravagant accessory like Brivani emerald and diamond earrings. A lot of people will not present their wealth at all in their clothing, says Langerman, while a lot of people will use it as a form of communication to let everybody know how wealthy they really are. Rebecca's most interesting accessory actually came from Eale herself, who showed up at a fitting wearing her own octagon-shaped glasses. Says Langerman, it allowed me to go really simple with a costume because she had this signature shape on her face. Succession, HBO. When Shiv, Roman, and Kendall Roy travel to a California estate and attempt to lock in a deal with the Pierce family in the first episode of the season, they wear outfits that say "We come in peace," says costume designer Michelle Matland. They were all in their least business attire, knowing that Nan was only going to welcome them if they didn't come as a team of troopers. Matland adds that the moment also allowed viewers to see a little bit about who they are when they're not with Logan. Each of the Roy offspring has transformed their looks over the seasons, with Kendall, Jeremy Strong, going from corporate to hipster to trying to fit into his father's world, and then throwing his hands up, I think, and deciding to find himself again after a lot of difficulties, says Matland. Of course, Kendall still uses his clothes to communicate how he wants to be seen. Not necessarily who he is, but who he would like to say to the world he is. I'm strong, I'm hip, I'm cool, I'm wealthy, says Matland. In contrast, Pierce family matriarch Nan, Cherry Jones, carries her generations of riches in a much different way. We see Nan come out in what she could have been gardening in. She has a much longer history of wealth, says Matland. But even Nan only wears the best designers, which speaks more to her limited view of the world rather than her specific desire to display her wealth. Her clothes are super high-end, and they're all labels, but not because she's pretentious, because that's all she knows, says Matland. They're limited to their understanding of the world, and her understanding of the world is fairly simple. This is old American money. 8 perfect episodes. Even on some of the best shows, there are chapters that stand above the rest. The Bear, Episode 7, Review, FX, by Savannah Walsh. There's ample salt, acid, and heat, but little fat to be found in The Bear's frenetic 7th episode, directed by creator Christopher Storer. Executive producer Joanna Kahlo describes it as a resting place for the season's character arcs, including Sydney and Richie's fractious dynamic and Carmi's increasingly rageful, deep, dark feelings hidden inside. all exacerbated by a rave review that brings a flood of customers their kitchen can't handle. But in writing the script, Kahlo says, it became this place where everyone exploded. The propulsive, almost 20-minute one-take result created this massive feeling of anxiety, which sort of encapsulates the energy that all people working in restaurants feel. Succession, Episode 3, Connor's Wedding, HBO, by Chris Murphy. Best not to get married on HBO. In Connor's Wedding, the third episode of Succession's final season, the eldest Roy's nuptials on a boat quickly get overshadowed by an event of truly epic proportion, Logan Roy's unexpected, ultimately unceremonious death. Rather than capture the fall of the king, director Mark Mylod focuses what he called his sadistically voyeuristic camera on the Roy siblings as they find themselves literally and emotionally at sea in a world without their father. It had to stay really close without taking its eye off of them, he said, because every time we cut away from the siblings, it seemed to let them off the hook. With Connor's wedding, Succession simultaneously upended every expectation for the series while fulfilling its titular premise. What a way for L to the OG to go. Reservation Dogs, Episode 8, This Is Where the Plot Thickens, FX, by Christian Allaire. Director Black Horse Low took inspiration from 1970s cinema for this surprisingly poignant episode, which swerves away from its central characters to follow tribal cop Big Zahn McLarnon after he mistakenly chugs a bottle of soda laced with psychedelic drugs. Walking through the pulsating, spinning forest, Big winds up on an introspective journey to the past, confronting his feelings of guilt over the death of his friend Cookie. In this seemingly fun, trippy episode, we actually really get deep into character, says series co-creator Sterling Harjo. There's a pain that drives Big. There's also a heavy dose of native humor, like when Big stumbles upon a mysterious group of secret society members in the woods, chanting things like, "The earth is a whore, and it is our will to take her." The punchline? The cult ends up not being an hallucination at all. Fleischman is in Trouble, Episode 7, Me Time, FX, by Case Wickman. Jesse Eisenberg's Toby and his woes dominate much of the first six episodes, but by the penultimate Me Time, it becomes clear he is not the Fleischman in real trouble. His missing ex-wife, Rachel, Claire Danes, reappears in this episode, which serves as both an explanation of where she's been and a showcase of what Danes does best, raw, messy emotion. Before the pandemic, I'd written my book out of a sort of primal scream, says Taffy Brodesser Ackner, who adapted her book for the series, and a primal scream defines this episode, too. Growing apart from her married boyfriend, Rachel lets loose in a therapy session so loud it shakes the trees outside. It's a taut, cathartic reflection on what happens when your heart feels overstuffed and empty all at once. Andor, Episode 12, Rick's Road, Disney Plus, by Anthony Bresnahan. It all builds to a brick. The first season's extraordinary climax takes place at the funeral march for Marva, Fiona Shaw, the adoptive mother of Diego Luna's title rebel leader, whose remains have been forged into a hexagonal funerary stone. When Marva delivers her own fiery eulogy by way of pre-recorded hologram, a riot breaks out, and Marva's brick becomes a weapon used to clobber Imperial soldiers. That is when the movie-making takes off past the script, says series creator Tony Gilroy. I remember being really surprised when I saw it and going, "Holy, look what they did." Dead Ringers, Episode 2, Prime Video, by Rebecca Ford. Deliciously twisted and unpredictable, The episode follows twin gynecologist Elliot and Beverly Mantle, both played by Rachel Weisz, as they attend a weekend getaway hoping to convince a billionaire, Jennifer Eale, to invest in their bespoke fertility center. We wanted to give them the gift of that center, but make sure it came from a really morally corrupt place, says showrunner Alice Birch. The tension builds as vulgar Elliot and uptight Beverly stumble their way through an awkward dinner party, alienating every despicable board member along the way. A late-night game of kidnapping eventually pushes Beverly to her breaking point, and she lashes out at the wealthy elite who are holding the keys to their future. Says the episode's writer, Ming Pfeiffer, so much of what was encapsulated in that monologue came from this collective rage that we were all feeling. The Last of Us, Episode 3, Long, Long Time, HBO, by David Canfield. If The Last of Us broadly expanded what a video game adaptation could look like, the radical Long, Long Time exploded it. This third installment of HBO's action-packed post-apocalyptic drama series, centered on two minor characters from the game, survivalist Bill, Nick Offerman, and the love of his life, Frank, Murray Bartlett. It spans decades, taking the shape of a gorgeous, timeless romance that deepens the series' exploration of connection and resilience. It was about showing both the passage of time and the creation of a functioning relationship, says co-showrunner Craig Masson, who wrote the episode. It implied that two people could have success in this world. Party Down, Episode 3, First Annual P12A Symposium, Stars, by Hilary Bursis. The hapless servers of Party Down's eponymous catering company reach a new low when they find themselves slinging canapé at a convention of cheery white supremacists, or, as Ken Marino's flailing manager Ron puts it, guys who are not Nazis. But terrifying as their views may be, the men of P12A, including Perfect Episode MVP Offerman, are also clearly losers. We wanted to speak to that, this idea that nobody really cares about them, that all they want is to just get more attention, co-creator John Enborn says. At first, he and his team worried that the episode might feel dated. What if by the time it aired, the far-right loonies of the Trump era had faded from public view? It's safe to say that didn't happen. Bad for the world, Enborn says, but good for Party Down. And here's a chart by Hilary Bursis, Murderer's Row. So many hit shows center on charismatic killers, but, spoiler alert, which of these devils actually deserve our sympathy? Series, 1923. The Yellowstone prequel flashes back to the cattle-ranching Duttons in the Prohibition era, Paramount Plus. Killer, Kara Dutton. Motive, a dastardly gang of sheepherders ambushes the Duttons' wagon, trying to kill Kara and her kin. How they did it? A single shot in self-defense. No jury would convict. Series, Bad Sisters. Who killed John Paul, a man his wife's, Grace's, four sisters refer to only as the prick? Let's find out. Apple TV Plus. Killer, Grace Williams. Motive? Yes, it's poor, abused Grace herself, who snaps when she learns JP also assaulted one of her sisters, Eva. How they did it? Strangling via PJs. Series, Dead to Me. Nothing bonds a pair of unlikely pals better than the aftermath of one, no, two, homicides. Netflix. Killer, Jen Harding. Motive? The terrible man she kills isn't quite as bad as JP, but he was pretty rude to her, and he launders money. How they did it? Beware toy birds. Series, Only Murders in the Building. The comedy's second season revolves around the murder of cranky Bunny Folger, Hulu. Killer, Poppy White. Motive, to gin up material for a podcast, which might actually make Poppy this page's biggest sociopath. How they did it? Knitting needles, the hipster's knife. Series, You, four seasons and two continents later, the ex-bookstore clerk is still getting away with murder. Netflix. Killer, Joe Goldberg. Motive, Joe would say that underneath it all, he just wants love, but his own hallucinations would call BS. How they did it? Pick your poison. Series, Barry. Who thought the Marine-turned-actor's life would get even bloodier after he stopped being a hitman? HBO. Killer, Barry Berkman. Motive, PTSD, rage, anxiety, self-preservation, desperation. Did we mention this is a comedy? How they did it. Mostly guns, but he's resourceful. Series, The Patient. A serial killer kidnaps a therapist, hoping to be cured. Things turn out just about as well as you'd guess. FX. Killer, Sam Fortner. Motive, anger, resentment, and kitchen violations. Seriously, he's a restaurant inspector. How they did it? Bare hands. Machine Dreams, the creator of the beloved cult hit Dickinson, on how she learned to stop worrying and love AI by Elena Smith, with illustration by Nicolas Ortega, which shows the robot director and the director's chair toppled over on its side. Before you know it, they say robots will be making our TV shows. At this very moment, the machines are learning to generate full-length screenplays, to spin up dazzling sets and locations, to deepfake 3D rotatable stand-ins for your favorite actors, to bust out all new needle drops of algorithmically regurgitated data sets that more or less amount to Taylor Swift, and all without paying a single fee or residual. So if you thought we were already drowning in content, girl, strap in. Soon every teen with a computer can be a showrunner. It's just a matter of entering the right prompts. They've already got Infinite Seinfeld running on Twitch. Given that, as an AI chatbot adequately trained in English idioms might put it, the horse has left the barn, it seems there's nothing any of us can do to prevent this oncoming flood of digital spew. So perhaps the move for us bedraggled mortals, stuck in our sloppy, stubbornly circadian carcasses, is to humbly step aside. We had a good run with our myriad millennia of arts and culture, but I'm calling it now. That's a wrap. It'll be easier for all of us going forward if we just take everything human out of the equation. Let the robots make the shows. Let the robots pick the shows. Let the robots distribute the shows. Hell, let the robots watch the shows. Imagine the metrics you'd rack up with a bot farm dedicated solely to clicking on, for example, true crime mockumentaries with sexy scammer protagonists set at the bottom of the ocean. And then you could send those calculations over to the robots on Wall Street who'd crunch them into profit statements, numbers that only go up. Don't you see how much more efficient show business can be? Just stand back and let the algorithm do its thing, smoothing out the assembly line, removing all risk of surprise or failure, achieving the singularity of taste and product of the pigs and the trough. People don't need to be involved in telling stories anymore. Just let it be bots all the way down. Of course, if you've worked in Hollywood over the past 10 years, you're probably thinking, isn't that pretty much already how things are? The future does have a creepy way of sneaking up on us and revealing itself to be the present. The businesses formerly known as theatrical film and broadcast and cable TV have by now, like the journalism and music industry before them, been subsumed into the vast cauldron of digital streaming soup. There's no such thing as a movie star anymore, because there's really no such thing as a movie. And because all of us are stars now, with our TikToks and B-Reels and myriad other fun do-it-yourself home surveillance kits. Nor is there any such thing as an old-fashioned blockbuster hit anymore. Or if there is, no one will tell us, because that would require the tech behemoths that own all our little shows to relinquish some of their blank-faced control by opening up those black boxes of data and being honest about who's watching any of this shit, how much that's worth to their bottom lines, and why. The sexiest person in Hollywood of 2023 is an accountant, someone who actually gets to touch the math. But maybe those jobs have been outsourced to robots, too. So the coming onslaught of AI-generated, algorithmically cooked storytelling may not be so much a paradigm shift as a continued succumbing to forces already at work, assiduously massaging the life and the magic out of what used to be known as entertainment. Does anyone really doubt an AI could handle the next 40,000 superhero sequels? And who, in the dazed, content-battered audience, would protest? Surely not the generation of smooth-brained youths who have barely left the house in 4 years, whose interiorities have oozed out of them, becoming one with the feed. Those poor kids with their Roblox and their Minecraft and their porn addictions, who have surrendered all their privacy, yet still ended up with a loneliness epidemic. They'll take a replica for a friend, so no doubt they'll gladly watch the shows the robots give them. And robots, as executives know, are so much easier to work with than people. Robots don't need COVID protection on set. Robots won't be heartbroken when you throw out an entire series they shot in exchange for a tax break. Robots would never ask for an intimacy coordinator. But there's something in that word, intimacy, that catches me here, makes me pause. Could an AI have a moment like this while generating? Is it possible that this one word might capture the whole reason we tell stories and listen to them in the first place? Couldn't you say that we need stories because they help us coordinate our intimacies? They allow us to explore, alone in the dark or at home on the couch, at a sleepover or on a first date, who we are with each other. Stories about families, coworkers, criminals, spies, even, yes, robots, are made of and necessitated by human relationships. Through stories, we, first as children, then as adolescents and adults, learn how to treat each other. We learn how to care. This capacity for empathy is what gives stories their stakes. What's fundamentally at stake in every story is the tender, vulnerable human heart. Stephen Sondheim, surely one of the greatest non-algorithmic intelligences ever to practice the craft, said, "The only reason to write is from love. Robots, as far as I know, can't love. So how can they write? Or more to the point, why would we listen to what they have to say?" This requirement of intimacy, vulnerability, care, is, when you come down to it, what makes the work of telling stories so hard for writers, actors, directors, everyone who labors together on a set to midwife a new film or TV show into existence. You have to bring your humanity to the job. You have to risk your heart. If a story doesn't make you feel anything, check again. You might be reading a microwave instruction booklet or a screenplay generated by ChatGPT. At a base level, a large language model is a tool designed to select the word or phrase that's most likely to come next, given the statistical distribution of words in the public corpus. It is a machine for plagiarism, a machine for cliché. Think about it. Do you really want, say, female characters generated from the existing data set of what has been said about women in the past? Are we going to let the robots tell us who we are? But maybe this fundamental truth about stories is what robotically generated text and images will help us clarify. Maybe the AI revolution will turn out to have an upside, which is that by churning out so much bullshit, it will inadvertently raise the bar. In a world of AI scripted content, the truly scarce commodity will be a show or film that reminds us of what we truly value, what we actually need in order to survive, which is to have a conversation, to be touched, to go into the woods of our human feelings, as Sondheim might say, and return transformed by a magical gift that only another all-too-real person can give us. So, while we let the robots have a crack at it, let's go back to the cave and hit restart on this whole human creativity thing. We can sit in a circle, tell jokes, maybe throw some shadow puppets on the wall. Does anyone know how to build a fire? Aubrey Plaza, and more in the next installment of Vanity Fair Magazine. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B stream via the World Wide Web and are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.